So Kiara is one of my collaborators on this, and Kristen Ayers, a grad student in biomath at UCLA, is another collaborator. I'm going to talk about what's called a dictionary model. Many of you are probably familiar with it. This was proposed by Busmaker in year 2000. I heard about this model from Eric Sigia at a IPAM conference shortly thereafter, and was rather fascinated by it. A dictionary model is constructed by concatenating words. Very simple. There's no grammar. There are only words in the dictionary. But each word has an assigned probability to it. So you're selecting words with randomly from a predefined dictionary. And in DNA sequence data, you don't have any punctuation marks, and you don't have any spaces. So there, of course, is an interesting inverse problem of constructing the dictionary, which we'll talk about as we go along. The bases in a DNA sequence dictionary are kind of words of length one, and they serve as background variation. Here's an example. Here are the words in the dictionary, and you can see that you can construct a sequence simply by concatenating those words. Each one of those colored blocks you would imagine would be a sequence of bases of anywhere from 1 to 25 letters, for example. I'm going to go over this quickly because it's something that I actually talked about in an earlier IPAM talk, so I don't want to dwell on it today, but we extended this model to permit alternative spellings and Bayesian priors. There were some issues in correctly computing the likelihoods that we cleaned up. We derived algorithms for maximum likelihood and maximum a posteriori estimation of parameters. Designed another algorithm for computing posterior probabilities of motif occurrence, and then implemented the algorithms in code and applied them to E. coli data and microarray data. And the model's been relatively successful. I would not say wildly successful, but successful. In collaboration with some people in the School of Engineering at UCLA, we applied it to binding sites in E. coli. We were able to find many of the known binding sites and predict new ones. We were able to improve on the spelling variations in a systematic way. In finding motifs, the worst problems we encountered were when motifs actually overlapped. And you can imagine that would give any model probably trouble. We do somewhat better than competing methods using similarity scores. And I'll show some of our results on the next slide. These are binding domains in E. coli. We use kind of a preset dictionary, but we improve the spelling, and then we look for new sites. So we have one column here is recovered sites. We certainly missed some sites, and we have imputed a lot of sites that weren't in the experimental literature. How many of those are real, we don't know. We also applied the method to microarray data. So this was data where E. coli was exposed to UV light, and that turns on certain genes regulated by what's a motif, a binding protein called LexA. And in typical fashion, and other people have certainly done this as well, we express the log change in gene expression. We regress that against the expected number of binding sites in each upstream region of each gene. And not surprisingly, the explanatory variable with the most significant result with LexA. We did pick up other predictors. Here's one. Certainly, there were none of them approached the significance of LexA, so it was a moderately successful exercise. Now, this is a simpler system than the mammalian system, so it's you don't have to scan as long a part of the genome to look for motifs, and it's so it's not terribly surprising we did fairly well. Here was the motif with the final estimated motif for Lex A. The heights of the letters are roughly proportional, I think, to the logs of the estimated usage probabilities. Now, what I really want to talk about is the analog of this dictionary model for haplotypes and haplotyping problem. So this is kind of a hapmap talk. And this is the work we've done in the last year and a half. So there's a number of points I want to make about haplotypes. There's certainly limited haplotype diversity across the genomes, particularly in short chromosome segments. There's extreme linkage disequilibrium. And people have expended a great deal of energy finding so-called tagging SNPs so that they don't have to genotype as many SNPs in, say, human association studies. The early papers argued that haplotypes broke along fairly sharp boundaries, block boundaries. In fact, haplotypes straddle block boundaries, and I'll show you even in the original papers where that's the case. And what we wanted to do was construct a phenomenological model to interpret the results of the haplotype block experiments. The dictionary model falls in this phenomenological category. It's not a mechanistic model. The mechanistic models, in my opinion, are probably too hard to deal with. This is the data from the Daly et al. Paper. It's hard to read, but there are a lot of genes, a lot of SNPs. Here are haplotypes. Here are the putative blocks, but you can see even across block boundaries, certain haplotypes extend rather nicely. These are the probabilities of the dominant haplotypes segments within each block. So a rather busy slide. We'll come back to analysis of this in a moment. So let's get down to some definitions and a little further commentary. Some combination of marker allele that almost always occur together. The block boundaries have been interpreted as corresponding to recombination hotspots. I'm not sure that this is the reasons are absolutely compelling. There's genetic drift and population bottlenecks. There's all kinds of historical evidence in these populations that we don't have access to. But all the historical paradigm is an alternative explanation to the recombination hotspot explanation. Consecutive blocks are a parsimonious way of describing the genome, even if they don't reliably reflect human evolutionary history. And there are too many algorithms to mention for finding these blocks. Now, it's a little bit of a case of if you have an algorithm that is predicated on looking for blocks, you're going to find them. We wanted to design algorithms and models that weren't predicated on sharp block boundaries. And it seemed to us that we could adapt the dictionary model to this purpose. We haven't been successful in all of these reasons for doing modeling haplotype blocks. Understanding the forces behind the formation of the blocks is certainly a very long-term issue. Predicting the extent of linkage disequilibrium is relatively well captured by the block model. And we can, although I won't talk about it, take account of the model to predict tagging SNPs and select them. And I will talk a little bit about the implications of the model for genotype calling and construction of haplotypes in absence of family data. So you may know that haplotypes usually are inferred from family data. You have genotyped family, parents, children, maybe grandchildren at the same loci, and you can infer locus by locus what is the maternal and what is the paternal allele. Okay, so we felt that haplotyping was rather similar to parsing DNA sequence data. The alphabet varies from marker to marker because, in fact, the number of alleles, if nothing else, varies from marker to marker. Even if you have SNP markers, the particular bases that are involved vary. As I've emphasized, we don't have sharp block boundaries. In practice, the observed data consist of multi-marker genotypes, and those are unphased. So these phase ambiguities complicate haplotyping. In some cases, as I mentioned, you can deduce phase from relatives, or if you've got the experimental setup, you can type isolated chromosomes. That's a fairly expensive proposition, though. Okay, so I'm going to give some definitions here. Some of them are slightly at variance with what's in the literature, so I'll try to walk through these carefully. So each haplotype sequence we view as constructed by concatenating haplotype segments. And a haplotype segment is just some ancestral combination of alleles at contiguous markers that tend to be co-transmitted. Now, in contrast to a word in a DNA motif dictionary, the haplotype segments always have a starting marker and an ending marker. So you can't shift them around. They have to live at a certain locale. And this is perhaps the most confusing thing of all, but I'm going to call the haplotype segments in the dictionary that span a given marker segment a haplotype block. So block here is used in the sense of a collection of haplotypes, all starting and ending at segments, starting and ending at the same pair of markers. Haplotypes have misspellings, and they can be due to mutation or genotyping errors, and we would like to take into account both. If there's true polymorphism because of an early mutation in the formation of a haplotype segment, then probably best to replace the segment by two different segments. Our marker segments corresponding to different blocks can definitely overlap, though. So here's a typical dictionary. The two colors indicate the two SNP alleles. So we have 22 markers. The intensity of the color is proportional to the frequency in the population. And so you can see there's some overlap in this here region. Sharp block boundary there. We have looked at much more complicated dictionaries, but this is one to start with. Now I want to show you how one calculates in this framework, because it's important to have some probability model. So a marker segment is just a sequence of consecutive indices, the marker indices. You number the markers 1 through m. And if you have a haplotype, what you see at the markers along that segment, I'll denote by h sub of the segment. And then a haplotype block is a collection of haplotype segments that start and end at two markers I and J. These blocks are assigned probabilities. And if I fix the starting point of a block and go to all possible ending points, these probabilities must sum to 1. So those are some of the parameters in the model. Now you also have certain conditional probabilities. So if you condition on using a haplotype segment from a given block, then you have the conditional probability of that segment R sub S, and these must also sum to 1. And then a partition, you think of your haplotype as partitioned into haplotype segments, so if you have m markers in all, you have a certain number of marker segments, The first one begins with marker 1, the last one ends with the last marker M, and in a segment pi I, if it ends with marker J, then segment pi I plus 1 starts with marker J plus 1. So it's a very simple idea. Okay, within this context, you can start then carrying over the machinery from hidden Markov chains. So you have both a forward algorithm for likelihood computation and a backward algorithm. The forward algorithm, you carry along, it's a joint probability, so E sub I here is the event that a random haplotype of a certain length M is constructed with a haplotype segment ending at marker I. So you have a definite cut place where there's a segment ends at marker I, and then Fi is the probability of the data up to that marker joint with the probability that a segment ends at that marker. Your forward algorithm starts F0 is 1, and it updates according to this. This is a kind of a sandwich formula. Here's the forward probability where you have a marker, you have a segment ending at marker I minus K. You plunk in a segment, you choose a block that extends from I minus K plus 1 to I. That's your choice probability. And then you insert a given haplotype segment with probability R sub H subscripted the marker. And to make this doable, you have to have some kind of limit on the maximum length of a haplotype segment. And when you get done, you get the probability at the end of the haplotype itself. So the idea is you have missing information, you don't know where the boundaries between the segments are, but this algorithm allows you to compute the likelihood in linear time and therefore is quite efficient.
Okay. Yeah. You must have some independence assumptions here.
Yes, every time you pull out a haplotype segment, well, okay, so you're building the
blocks, is it cross segments?
What's that?
Is it blocks or segments that are independent?
Well, there's both. So you're building the haplotype from left to right. So you pick out, you say, well, we're going to start with marker 1, and we have various blocks that we can pick, all starting at marker 1 but ending at different points. So we pick a block, given the block probabilities, then once we have the block picked, we pick a segment randomly from the block. Once we get that segment, we plunk it into the haplotype that we're growing, and then we go on to the next choice. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm still a little confused. Do you have different dictionaries at different locations, different segments?
Well, the dictionary is this collection of blocks and segments, if you want.
Which are indexed by their positions.
That's correct. You always have the words, the segments of length 1, so they're the kind of the background. So you start here, you have a random choice of how long the first segment's going to be, you make that random choice with the given probabilities, then you have a block of possible segments you can choose from, you pick one.
But essentially the dictionary for the second block would now be usable for the dictionary.
That's correct. Right. That's correct. That's the difference between the motif and the haplotype dictionary. So they're not completely analogous. In the backward algorithm, you compute with conditional probabilities. Again, you have EI is the event that a random haplotype length M is constructed with a haplotype segment ending at marker I. Then you're taking the probability of the end of the haplotype from that point on, given that there's a break there. Okay? You initialize, and again you have a recurrence relation. This is your choice probability for block size, the haplotype segment you choose, and then whatever
the probability to fill out the haplotype from there on. And if you go backwards, decrementing I, you get to B1, and that's the likelihood of the haplotype. Now, there are complications in this. For example, if you have genotyping error, which is a fairly common occurrence, then you have to have some device for handling the errors. One such way is to introduce a penetrance function. This is just the probability of the observed allele given the true allele at a given marker. Okay? And we've used, by and large, the simplest possible model, uniform error. So this is either 1 minus some error probability for a match or the error probability for a mismatch. Then in the forward and backward algorithms, this single probability corresponding to a single haplotype segment has to be replaced by a sum over all possible segments within a block using the penetrances, and this is an implied product multinomial model. Okay? With that change, then the forward and backward algorithms are then completely correct and incorporate genotyping error. Okay, now if you have multi-marker genotypes, then you have yet another level of difficulty. So you have a maternal and a paternal haplotype. That's what's underlying the data you've collected. You don't know at any given marker whether you have two alleles, which one is the maternal and which one is the paternal, unless you have a heterozygote. So you have to, in essence, sum over all possibilities. Okay? So if you ignore error, then this size of the set of pairs of haplotypes is a power of 2, and it depends on the number of heterozygous genotypes along the collection of markers. Now, if parents are types, some of the heterozygous genotypes can be resolved. In fact, if you have codominant alleles, no genotyping error, and both parents are type, a marker has a probability of at least 1/8 of presenting, of at most 1/8 of presenting a phase ambiguity. So most of the time, you can resolve the phase ambiguity by looking at the parents. The situation where you can't occur when the parent, both parents and the child are the same heterozygote, then you can't deduce what came from which parent. Otherwise, you can. If you have only one parent type, this probability increases to 1/4. So it's still relatively favorable. Okay, now, if you have a dictionary of these haplotype segments, you want to estimate the block probabilities and the segment probabilities and the error probabilities, quite possibly. These are all examples of hidden multinomial trials. And you can, because you have missing data here, you can use an EM algorithm. And the EM algorithm for hidden multinomial trials says you update your parameter, which is a probability that an outcome falls in a given cell, by a ratio. The ratio is a ratio of 2 conditional expectations. One is the expected number of trials, and the other is the expected number of categories, successes in the given category. Okay? These update formulas are natural outcomes of the forward and backward algorithms. I'll show you maybe a little bit more later, but if you record as you go along the FI and the BI, the things that you get out of the forward and backward algorithm, then you get kind of sandwich formulas for calculating the conditional expectations in the numerator and denominator. So those conditional expectations are conditional on the data and your current parameter values. Now, if you want to implement Bayesian analysis, then you can impose a Dirichlet prior on the hidden multinomial trials, and you're basically updating the numerator and denominator by adding kind of pseudo counts and
So it's a trivial modification of the EM algorithm to get a maximal a posteriori estimation procedure. Okay, now the inverse problem, of course, is much harder, and this is one we've struggled with, and there's probably no absolutely best solution to it. So the inverse problem is construct a dictionary from the observed haplotype data. Now, in the original Busmaker paper, what they did is kind of an interesting exercise. They took the first 10 chapters of Moby Dick, and they took out all the punctuation and all the spaces between the letters, and they attempted to reconstruct the English words that were used by the author. And you can see they actually were relatively successful, except they would get compound words like of the that would occur quite commonly. Two words were not really independent of one another, and they would come up as a constructed word in the dictionary. One way of looking at this inverse problem is to use minimum description length criteria, and it's an attempt to strike some kind of compromise between completeness and parsimony. So what the minimum description length approach does is it minimizes a sum. Well, part of that is the negative log likelihood, and we would use the maximum likelihood value and then take its negative. So you have to estimate parameters. And then penalty terms reflecting the complexity of the dictionary. So the penalty would involve the number of parameters, the size of each haplotype blocks, and the complexity of the haplotype segments in each haplotype block. So there's various levels of penalization going on. So within that framework, then, you have to have some kind of heuristic for getting the dictionary started, and then you have to be able to kind of grow it, and you have to prune it. And you alternate these growing and pruning steps until you converge on something that looks fairly stable. So we start with a fairly large dictionary assembled with short to medium length haplotype segments that seem to be overrepresented in the data. Any method of defining rigid block boundaries will, in fact, give such a dictionary, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time explaining how that goes. In the growing phase, we look at, we concatenate adjacent haplotype segments. So there are two blocks, they're neighboring blocks, and we look at one segment from one block and one segment from the other block, and we try to determine whether the concatenation is overrepresented in the data or not. If so, and this is done in kind of an empirical sense, then the concatenated segment is added. So you can grow the dictionary by taking existing haplotype segments and just concatenate. Now because the single marker haplotypes are always part of the dictionary, you always have this opportunity to grow. You don't run out of things to enlarge the dictionary. In the pruning stage, we rank the blocks by their, quote, apparent usage probabilities, and we'll actually lop off whole blocks that don't seem to be used very often. We're always using the minimum description length criterion, but to avoid enormous numbers of maximum likelihood estimation problems, we use a kind of a bisection strategy. Pruning can be done not only on blocks, but it can be done on redundant haplotype segments within blocks. So for example, if we concatenate it to adjacent haplotype segments, it may be that we don't need each of those two individual segments anymore. Maybe the concatenation is really what all we're looking for. So we attempt to get rid of those by pruning as well. So growing and pruning basically is alternated until no further progress is made. Okay, so I'll show you some examples here. So we used 400 fully phased chromosomes generated without typing error. And according to the dictionary I showed earlier with 22 markers. And with 400 chromosomes, we were able to perfectly reconstruct the dictionary. So it's 22 SNPs, had 10 non-trivial haplotype segments. And I'll show you on the next figure the numerical details of that dictionary. We also undertook to reconstruct it when we had a 5% typing rate, error rate, and a 5% missing data rate. Missing data and is also a problem in real data sets. And I'll show you on the next figure what we got. Now, in this case, the reconstruction is not perfect because there's a confusing block overlap at SNPs 11 and 12. But the reconstruction tends to preserve the major details reasonably well. So here's the original dictionary. Here are the block probabilities. So we choose this block extending from marker 1 to marker 5 with probability a half. Or we choose here, say, a much larger block also, I guess, with probability half. This is the dictionary. And then these are the segment probabilities. And this is what we reconstructed. So what we correctly identify are these two segments, these two haplotype segments, these two, and those two. And it gets a little confused right in here because these are because of the typing errors and the missing data. Good, but not astonishing, but about what we expected. I'll show you a more complicated data set. This is the daily data set, the complicated slide I showed earlier. It was based on 103 SNPs, and they had 129 fully phased multi-marker genotypes. So we constructed two dictionaries. One with sharp block boundaries and one with overlapping boundaries. So the in our reconstruction, the two SNPs are colored red and blue. The color intensity of a haplotype segment is proportional to the probability of its appearance on a random chromosome. The minimum description length criteria overwhelmingly favors the overlapping dictionary. And in fact, the overlapping dictionary suggests phylogeny for some of the haplotype segments. This is the reconstruction with non-overlapping haplotypes. And this is the reconstruction with overlapping haplotypes. And you can see, which was it? The thing marked C. For example, these are sub-segments of the longer segments. These are probably cases where recombination has occurred and kind of scrambled the original segment. This, in my opinion, is a much more reasonable reconstruction of what's going on. And I don't want to deprecate, I think Daly and the other authors understood this, but some of the people subsequently have believed a little blindly in haplotype sharp block boundaries, and I think it's a useful exercise to have an alternative model that shows that they don't work as well as something a little more complicated.
Just one quick question about that slide.
Yeah.
So should you read this that the red and the blue color should both add up to one thing vertically? And if you observe them as probabilities?
You want to answer that, Kiara? She made this.
If you look at the starting position, the probability for all the segments that start at one position should add up to one. Now, those that start at one position may add at different positions, and also you may not get the full picture here because we don't represent on the picture one marker length.
Right. All of those are omitted.
So they're in completing the probability adding up to one, you always have to add those short haplotypes that are just one marker. So in some cases it may not turn out visually that you see them adding up to one.
doing. Yes?
Did you simulate any data using, say, the ancestral recombination graph to see whether the segments that you are inferring correspond to ancestral haplotype from the underlying evolutionary problem?
We should have, but we didn't. Well, we did go on to a more a practical problem, genotype calling and haplotype. So here we're interested in, a lot of pharmaceutical companies, for example, are conducting studies on random individuals. They don't have family data, so they can't haplotype. And the issue is, can a model like this actually help them recover haplotypes? Because haplotypes may have much more information about disease allele associations than single SNPs, any single SNP by itself. Haplotyping works best when block boundaries are not sharp. The more overlap there is, the better you can resolve things. With sharp boundaries, the two haplotype segments within each block might be well determined, but it's impossible to decide which is maternal and paternal. So the overall face uncertainty tends to grow almost geometrically with the number of blocks if the blocks have no overlap. So boundary straddling alleviates this problem. I'll show you an example of this in a moment. So in doing this, we chose to implement an MCMC algorithm for exploring haplotype pair space. Now, let me explain what this is. So we're conducting a simulation just on pairs of haplotypes considered the true haplotypes underlying the observations. Okay, and we could have possibly conducted a MCMC on a full segmentation of each haplotype, but that seemed like it was a much bigger phase space than necessary, and we can get by with a coarser grain, which I think gives better estimates. Okay. So we chose to go with a smaller state space. Now, to do this, we had to adjust slightly for genotyping error instead of what I gave earlier. We want something that applies to multi-marker genotypes given the true haplotype decomposition. And again, we adopt a product multinomial model, and these combination of terms are occurring because of the phase ambiguities. We don't know which allele, true allele, which of the observed alleles is maternal and which is paternal. But using the same penetrance probabilities, which are basically one minus an error or an error, match or mismatch, we can get the probability of the data given the point in state space we're currently operating on. So in the conducting the MCMC, we have two kinds of steps. One is a minor rearrangement, which is a Gibbs step. So in the Gibbs step, we choose a random marker, and we just resample the genotype, the unordered genotype at that marker. So if it's the markers are SNPs, there are four possibilities here. That makes for very small rearrangements. It's also valuable to have something that makes larger rearrangements. So in a Metropolis swap, we pick some marker, we have two haplotypes, and at that marker, we exchange parts. So that gives a much more violent rearrangement. So you get both local and global rearrangements of the existing state. And both moves are fairly quick to execute because you can compute these probabilities by the forward or backward algorithms. And I'm just giving you the probability of the data given the state you're in, which incorporates the genotyping here. So you run the chain maybe for a million steps, sample let's say every 100 steps, and as you sample you record the ordered and unordered genotypes at each marker, And the proportion of time each unordered genotype occurs, this provides the posterior probability of that genotype. Let's see. So these and we use these posterior probabilities to spot poor genotype calls. One of the things I've been working on is just calling genotypes. The chips are not infallible, and certainly the microsatellite calling is even less reliable. If you have SNPs that redundantly define haplotype segments, then you can correct these calls, and it's a nice device to have actually some redundancy. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend that you get down to the most minimum number of SNPs, because then you have little capacity to correct wrong genotype calls. We also record the proportion of time each unordered pair of haplotypes occurs. So this is the raw material then for haplotyping. If we can incorporate phase information from parents, if that's the case, then we don't visit a marker, or we don't move what's at that marker when we do a big exchange between the two haplotypes. So here's a typical true pair of haplotypes. This is what we observe. So we no longer have the ordered maternal paternal. Here are some missing data. Here's a genotyping error. These would be typical of what you would have in real data. This is based on that earlier model with 22 markers. So these are the haplotype pairs that come out with the highest posterior probability. So you don't haplotype absolutely reliably. I guess some of these are kind of, they all involve minor changes. And the greatest uncertainty is coming where I think the missing data was. Here, that's where the error was. So sometimes we're filling it in one way, and sometimes we're filling it in the other. Another thing you might want to do is compute for each haplotype segment the expected number of times it's actually used in your multilocus genotype. This is an interesting exercise, because then if you're doing association testing, say you're a pharmaceutical company, you don't have information on family, typically what they do is they'll almost set up a regression equation, and they'll say the SNP genotype is predicting disease status. Here we can use, instead of genotypes, we can use these haplotype segments, and we could use the expected number of copies of a given segment as a predictor for the disease status, or the, say, a quantitative value. So this, I think, has some use. So as we can get these expected number of copies as we run the chain, when we get a true haplotype, we can the conditional probability of given segment is used on the maternal and paternal pair, and we just keep a time average to get these expectations. It's again a kind of a sandwich formula: forward probability, backward probability, a block UC probability, and a haplotype segment probability divided by the whole probability of the haplotype. So all of these things come out as a byproduct of the forward and backward algorithms. So here's the kind of, we took one genotype. Here's the kind of things you get out. Your original dictionary, we've got four major haplotype segments that are used, and these are conditional on what you actually see at the multilocus genotypes, the probabilities that these segments are being used. As I said, these could then be used as predictors for association studies. And for genotyping error rate, we had a 5% error rate. This is the I guess this was, we just took someone who was homozygous across the whole genome. There was one case where there was some ambiguity, but most of the genotypes are called with high posterior probability in spite of the possibility of genotyping error. Okay, I think it's time to stop, and I'll stop.